Hello, Michael. Hello, Ernesto. Today we have a question that says like this. I've heard you and Ernesto say that you do not teach or that you do not do this for others, but for yourselves. Isn't this in a way selfish while your perception of being a body and a person has not yet ceased?
Right. Okay. This is a good question. If this were a subject, that is, when they said that we do this for ourselves, what are we trying to do? We're trying to get a clearer and deeper understanding of Bhagavan's teachings, and consequently a stronger motivation to go within. That's our aim. If this were just a philosophy that we were doing just for the sake of for the intellectual pleasure of having a nice philosophy and arguing with others or whatever, then that would be selfish because we're doing it for ourselves. Ourself means ourself is the person we seem to be. But if our aim is to be self-attentive and thereby to surrender ourselves, this is the very antithesis of selfishness, because selfishness means, in the term selfishness, the self referred to is ego. So, but in this part of self-investigation and self-surrender, our aim is to give up this ego. And to the extent to which we attend to ourselves, to that extent does ego subside. So if our aim in taking interest in this and talking about this and discussing it with others and so on, is just to create within ourselves more and more enthusiasm to put this into practice, to go within, then this is the very antithesis of selfishness. It is selflessness, because we're trying to get rid of that self to whom all selfishness occurs. That is, selfishness is only is a condition of ego. When ego is much concerned about itself, that is called selfishness. But itself means itself as the person that it seems to be. But here, we are not interested in the person that ego seems to be. We are interested in knowing the reality of ego. That is, ego is the false awareness, I am this person. I am Michael, or I am Carlos, or I am Ernesto. That which is aware of itself as I am Carlos, or I am Ernesto, or I am Michael, that is ego. But in that ego, there is an element of reality. That element of reality is I am. So our aim is to withdraw our interest from all other things and take interest only in knowing and being I am, knowing and being what we actually are. So this is the very antithesis of selfishness.
Some people maybe tell you, no? In my case, this occurs, no? Why you are not all the time in silence, trying to attend yourself instead of speaking, too many videos, too many classes, or all that? Because some people assimilate that or don't see that you can't stay speaking or discussing or anything else and attending yourself very keenly or as much you can, no?
Yes. Well, the deepest answer to that question is all the activities of the mind, speech, and body are destined to do, they will be made to do. So even if we are practicing self-attentiveness, if the mind is and speech and body are destined to do certain actions, they will be made to do those actions. Destined to do means if certain actions are necessary, in order for us to experience what we are destined to experience, we will be made to do these actions. Because destiny, in the sense of prarabdha, is the fruit of actions we've done in the past. The fruit of actions we've done in the past are are the experiences that are consequent on those actions. So the fruit of actions is all to do with experience. As Bhagavan says in verse 38 of Ulajanapu, if we are a doer of actions, we will experience the resulting fruit. So the fruit of what we experience as a consequence of the actions that we've done. So prarabdha essentially is the fruit of past actions. So, but in order for us to experience those fruits, certain actions of our mind, speech, and body may be necessary. Whatever actions are necessary in order for us to experience the fruit, we will be made to do. So strictly speaking, the actions we are doing are not according to, we are not destined to do those actions. We are made to do those actions in accordance with our destiny. There's a subtle distinction there. That is, the destiny is only the fruit of the actions, which are the experiences. But in order to experience the experiences, certain actions of our mind, speech, and body are necessary. So those actions that are necessary in accordance with our prarabdha, as Bhagavan says, he puts it very precisely in the first sentence of the note he wrote for his mother. He says, avarava prarabdha prakaram. In accordance with according to the prarabdha of each one, he who is for that, meaning God or Guru, angang girindu, being there, implying being in the heart of each one, atavipan, will make them act. So we'll be made to act in accordance with our prarabdha. In order to experience our prarabdha, we're made to do whatever actions are necessary for that. So, of course, we can't, that doesn't mean all the actions we do are in accordance with prarabdha, because at the same time as being made to do certain actions in accordance with prarabdha, we also have, we're also being swayed by our vasanas, our likes, dislikes, desires, and so on, and fears and everything. And these impel us to act. So our actions are driven by two forces. One is by our own will. In other words, our vasanas, our likes, dislikes, desires, and so on. We are also being driven by the will of God in order for us to experience our prarabdha. So the will of God and our will both are driving this mind, speech, and body. We cannot distinguish to what extent each action is driven by his will and to what extent it's driven by our will. Many actions may be driven by both. That is, we are destined to experience a certain thing. We happen to want to experience that. So we are made to do the actions necessary to experience it. We're made to do so by God in accordance with prarabdha. But we are anyway also being made to do so by our liking to experience that. So we cannot distinguish action between, distinguish the extent to which each action is driven by our will or by God's will or by a mixture of both. But if we are destined to do something, even if we remain wholly absorbed in self-attentiveness, this mind, speech, and body will be made to do those actions. That is one way of answering. Another way of answering is, in practice, so supposing we decided not to engage in any activities, any external activity, if we could, if it wasn't in our, we could do so only if it was in our prarabdha to avoid activity. But supposing we decide we're going to avoid all activity, we're just going to sit here, meditate on ourselves. Even if we're sitting still, sitting like a log of wood, so like straight like a tree trunk, and are moving, there's no saying where our mind may be moving. Our mind may be wandering here, there, and everywhere. So merely refraining from external activity is not the real renunciation. The real renunciation is renouncing the doership and experiencership. That is, so long as we take this body, speech, and this whole bundle, body, speech, and mind, to be ourselves, whatever actions are done by this body, speech, and mind are experienced by us as I am doing this. Even those actions that we are made to do by God in accordance with our prarabdha, we still feel I am doing this. I am studying. I am working hard. I am earning a lot of money. As if it was all by our effort we are achieving all these things. So long as we experience these body, speech, and mind as ourselves, we experience the actions done by them as actions done by us. This is the doership. And the flip side of doership is experiencership. Not only do we do the actions, we also experience the resulting fruit. Of course, the fruit we are now experiencing are not the fruit of actions that we've done in this life. They're the fruit of actions we did in previous lives. But we are the doership and experiencership are inseparable. So long as there is doership and experiencership, even if you're sitting perfectly still, I am meditating, I am in samadhi or whatever, there's still doership there because you still identify yourself as the one who is deep in meditation. So the renunciation that is required is not the renunciation of action, but the renunciation of doership. And doership is synonymous with ego. Because when we rise as ego, we experience ourselves as the mind, speech, and body, which are the doers of actions. So we inevitably have doership so long as we rise as ego. We cannot free ourselves from doership without eradicating ego. Only by eradicating ego that we can be free of doership. So if you truly want to be free of action, you need to be free of doership. And if you want to be free of doership, you need to be free of ego, because doership is the very nature of ego.
But if we compare, for example, staying in silence without the sense of being the doership, and staying in silence feeling that you are making meditation or similar, no? In the last video, do you remember that we was talking about the difference between the self-remembration or remember of yourself,
yes,
a partial attentiveness, compares or instead of very keenly attentiveness without remember yourself, no?
Yes.
We know that the prarabdha karma is the law, no?
Yes.
In what actions or what, but we know too that our will to only stay in the Atma Swarupa,
yes,
without any actions, without any, yes, no, this will is very important in the equation.
Yes.
What do you think?
Who is it who is trying to remain in Atma Swarupa? Who is it who is trying to be absorbed in Atma Swarupa? It is ego.
To dissolve. No,
yes,
not.
Yes.
No,
I'm answering the question now. That is, it is ego that is trying to be absorbed in Atma Swarupa. The actions are done by mind, speech, and body. Actions are done by ego because of ego's identification with mind, speech, and body. So the mind, speech, and body cannot be absorbed in Atma Swarupa. Only ego can be absorbed in Atma Swarupa. So let the mind, speech, and body do whatever actions they are made to do. That is no concern of ours. Our only concern should be to be absorbed in Atma Swarupa. In other words, to be as keenly self-attentive as possible. The more keen our self-attentiveness, the more we will subside. And the more we subside, the more we are thereby detaching ourselves from this mind, speech, and body. So we are trying to extricate ourselves out of this doership. In order to give up doership, you don't need to give up action, because action is not done by us. Action seems to be done by us only because of doership. If we give up the doership, we are effectively giving up the action. But that doesn't mean the action doesn't go on. The action will go on according to destiny, in accordance with destiny.
At what extent you can reduce the feel that you are the doership?
To the extent to which you attend to yourself. to the extent to which you attend to yourself, ego thereby subsides. To the extent to which ego subsides, to that extent does the doership drop off. But we cannot be completely free of doership without eradicating ego.
Yes. But as more we attend yourself, if the doership reduce,
yes,
the intensity of love to be very absorbing yourself grows, respect of the
yes.
speech and mind actions of all of that, no?
That is that speech, body, speech and mind, they are completely separate. They are instruments of action. It is we as ego who has to have the love to be absorbed in ourselves. In other words, to be as we actually are. By holding fast to self-attention. So we are trying to detach ourselves from these instruments of action. The instruments of action are body, speech, and mind. We seem to be entangled with these because the nature of ego is to grasp these as itself. So we, by clinging to self-attentiveness, we are disentangling ourselves from this mind, speech, and body. And the more we, the deeper we go in this practice, the more we become familiar with being self-attentive, the more detached we will become from the mind, speech, and body. Yes, we may still be aware of them, but we are less concerned about them.
It's like ego is cutting off its own fuel, like little by little to turn within.
Yes.
Little by little, it's like, in a way, it's like, well, it's as that willingness to be more self-attentive until you dissolve back in.
Yeah, yes. That is, the more we are self-attentive, in other words, the more we are attached to ourself, ourself means ourself as we actually are, the more we will be detached from other things. If you want to let go of everything that is not yourself, hold on to yourself. If you want to let go of everything that is unreal, hold on to what is real. What is real is only I am. The more we hold on to I am, the more we are letting go of other things. This is how we develop what is sometimes called Udasina Bhava, that attitude of indifference. We're no longer concerned about these things. Yes, so long as there's body, speech, and mind, this body will have problems. It will get diseases, it'll get old age, it'll get death, and also it may be involved in accidents. All sorts of things may happen. And in the course of our life as a person, we may face all sorts of problems. Everyone faces problems of one kind or another. It's not that these problems are going to stop, or the body's suddenly going to become healthy or anything. We become indifferent to things. They no longer matter. Yeah, this body is here, what, for just a few years. A few years, hence it's going to die, and it's going to be, the hole is going to be dug in the ground, and it's going to be plonked in that hole, or it's going to be put in a fire and burned. Why we attach so much importance to the little life of this person? Because we take this person, this body, to be ourself. But the more we hold on to self-attentiveness, the more we will become detached from this person that we take ourselves to be. And the more indifferent we will become to all its pleasures and pains.
The problem for some people maybe is when they try to be indifferent, no? Respect the things of the body, yeah. the his life or yeah. similar. But in the background, he feels responsible of yeah. of this.
So we're not really indifferent. We can't be indifferent just by trying to be indifferent. If we want to be indifferent, we need to let our hold on these other things needs to be loosened, and we can loosen our hold on other things only by tightening our hold on ourselves. The more we hold on to ourselves, the more we hold on to I am, the more our grip on other things will get loosened. and eventually we'll be willing to let go of everything else and to merge back into the source from which we rose.
Then this indifference or dasina is a consequence of this.
It's a consequence. It's a consequence.
It's,
yes.
It's not what we can do to try. Yeah. No, yeah, we are yeah, trying yeah, to do yeah, indifference yes, when I'm not indifferent.
Yes.
And what about the feelings?
If you have desire for something, suppose you've got a desire for a very tasty meal, can you give up that desire by just thinking, oh, I must be indifferent to this tasty meal? As soon as you see that, the desire springs up. You can't just get rid of a desire by trying to will the desire away. We need to, that's why a much deeper strategy is necessary. In order to give up desire for other things, we need to cultivate the love for what alone is real, namely ourselves. More we hold on to ourselves, the more we are there by letting go of other things. So we can overcome desire for other things only by that this practice of self-attentiveness solves all our problems. That is why, so long as our vasanas are strong, we are not willing to go deep in this practice. This is, as Bhagavan said, this is the easiest of all practices. There cannot be any practice easier than being self-attentive. But why it seems to us so difficult? Because of our lack of willingness, because we are not yet willing to let go of other things. We can attend to ourselves. That is, whenever we attend to ourselves, we are thereby letting go of other things. So we can attend to ourselves only to the extent to which we are willing to let go of other things. And as Bhagavan says in verse 26 of Uddhudanapadu, if ego comes into existence, everything comes into existence. If ego doesn't exist, everything doesn't exist. Ego itself is everything. Therefore, investigating what this ego is giving up everything. So to the extent to which we are self-attentive, to that extent we are giving up other things. So until and unless we are willing to let go of other things, we will not be willing to be self-attentive. That is why this seems so difficult.
Yes. And this is why the likes and dislikes and the discipline, no?
To, yes.
And sorry, Carlos, you want to ask something?
Go ahead.
Yes?
Yeah.
Sometimes some people, Michael, ask me, I need to... I don't want to let go my custom to eat meal, no? Meat,
yes.
No?
Yeah.
What Bhagavan said, respect this, and I say Bhagavan is the first niyama, no? That he say that is a horrible habit, no? I think he said in Muruganar put in Palamalai, no?
Yeah.
Of the eat meat, no?
Yes.
But I don't know if I'm doing well when I say to some friends, no? That if you value this, when you act as you, it's like the what we were speaking about, the indifference, no?
Yes.
Similar, no?
Yes.
If you are not in the level of consciousness to respect the life, no? Try to impose this habit that not the ahimsa, no? When you feel that you want to eat that, no?
Yes.
It's a disassociation. Because you tried, I'm vegan, I'm vegetarian, no? Because ahimsa said, because Bhagavan said, but I don't want really that. I do because the teaching said, because Bhagavan said, but I'm lying me, no?
Yes.
An imposition, right?
Yes.
Yes. But this is even before we come to this path of self-investigation, I mean, this thing of being, of refraining from eating meat is a very, very basic thing. Firstly, I mean, we can take it from a moral perspective. We value our life so much. Every other living creature values its life just as much. Now we happen to be experiencing ourselves as a human body. In another life, we may experience ourselves as a cow or a pig or a dog or a elephant or a giraffe or a monkey or whatever. That is, it's just arbitrary, but now we happen to be have a human body. But having a human body, we have a more developed intellect, at least in some respects. And one of the we can use our intellect to recognize that other creatures have just as much attached just as much value to their own life and to their own comfort and freedom from pain that we attach to our life and our comfort and our freedom from pain. So what right do we have to inflict pain or suffering or discomfort or death on any other creature? We have no right at all. So from a moral perspective, there's no justification for eating meat. At least in normal circumstances, you can mention extreme cases like, well, what about the Eskimos? If they don't eat meat, they can't live because there's no other food available there. Those are exceptional circumstances. We are not Eskimos. And even in the modern day world, Eskimos probably have access to supermarkets and they can buy vegetables and fruits and things. So, we're talking about the situation we're in. For any person in the modern world, it is easy to be vegetarian. There's plenty of plant foods available. There's no necessity to eat meat. That is, except possibly in some very exceptional circumstances, for the vast majority of us, it is possible to, we have access to adequate vegetarian food. So there's no necessity for us to, or no justification for us to eat meat. So we can take it in a moral perspective. Also, if we've got compassion in our heart, how can we just need to think a little bit, and then the very idea of eating meat. I mean, when I was young, I was brought up in a meat-eating family. I didn't question it. It was only when I went to India and I became vegetarian, even without thinking about it, because I just happened to be eating vegetarian food because of a company I was mixing with. And after some time, I found the very idea of eating meat seemed to be abhorrent. So if anyone wants to know how to cultivate the liking to be vegetarian or vegan, my advice to them would be just for a few months, be vegetarian or vegan. If the mind is mature enough, after a few months of eating only a vegetarian or a vegan diet, the idea of eating anything else will become abhorrent to you. I'm not saying that will be the case for all people. If people, even after being vegetarian or vegan for a few months, if they still have desire for meat, that means their mind is not it's not spiritually very mature. But for most of us, for those who at least have a little spiritual maturity, a little bit of development of compassion, we just need a few months of not eating meat. But the thing is, if you eat meat, that has a tamasic effect on the mind. It dulls your mind. And therefore, it blunts your discrimination. So if you're a habitual meat eater, it may not seem wrong to you to eat meat. But if you give it up for a few months and allow your mind the more sattvic qualities to arise in the mind, if you've got a naturally sattvic mind, the idea of going back to meat would seem abhorrent to you. If your mind is still got a lot of tamas and rajas, then you may still like to go back to eating meat even after 3 months, 6 months, a year, 10 years, whatever. You may still have a liking for that. That just shows the predominance of rajas and tamas in your mind. that requires some more gemma, some more lives before you gain the maturity. But if our mind has a natural inclination towards sattva, if we give up eating meat, well, this is what I experienced in my case, we give up eating meat, after some time, we will gain the clarity to see that it's completely abhorrent to eat meat. I mean, the very idea of eating meat, of some other animal being killed and suffering just to satisfy our taste buds, it's a ridiculous idea. I mean, it's a wholly unjustifiable idea. Ultimately comes down to maturity of the mind. We can't force these things on people.
Yes. I think the same that you are telling, no? That is the goal's low, no?
Yes.
Don't do anything, anyone. You don't want that anyone makes to you. I think it's more simple that all of that is all of them have been conditioned in our lives, in our families. We are normalized the eat meat or eat animals that have been sacrificed. No,
yeah,
and it's not question, dude. You must do what Bhagavan's teaching said or what Niyama said, or you continue eating meat. No, it's review. What are your position? No. Maybe you are doing something without thinking, and what this implies in your life, in your relation,
But what Bhagavan says in Nana about Nitya Sattvika Ahara Niyama, that is the restriction of eating only sattvic food in moderate quantities, and sattvic food, meat and eggs and such things are rajasic and tamasic, so they're definitely not sattvic. And even milk, if the way milk is produced nowadays, which involves a lot of animal cruelty, even that is not sattvic. So it may be in old days in India, milk was considered as a very sattvic food, but that was at a time and in a condition where cows were treated very kindly. They weren't just treated as industrial commodities to produce vast quantities of milk. In the present day circumstances, the way milk is produced nowadays, it is no longer sattvic. I think we can say if because so much suffering goes into the production in this dairy industry. Firstly, it works hand in glove with the meat industry, and secondly, there's so much cruelty involved in it, so much suffering for those animals involved in it. So it's not sacred. So, coming back to what Bhagavan says in Nana, he says if we eat sattvic food in mitta means in moderate quantities, that the sattva guna of the mind will increase, and that will help in the practice of self-investigation. Sattva guna, sat means being. Sattva means beingness. That's the etymological meaning of sattva. So sattva means that quality of calmness, peace, and clarity. So for this practice of self-investigation, we need a calm and clear mind. So if we are not eating sattvic food, if we're eating excessive quantities of any food, or if we're eating non-sattvic food, if we're eating meat and such things that are very tamasic and rajasic in quality, that will definitely be an obstacle to our self-investigation, because our mind will be clouded and made dull. So, very restless also. So we want a calm and a clear mind in order to investigate ourselves. So, eating sattvic food is a great aid in this path. So much so that we need not, once we've understood this, we need not give it a second thought. Okay. Everyone has said this, yes, it makes perfect sense. So we should try to eat only sattvic food in moderate quantities. So the very idea of eating meat, we should put out of our minds and heart once and for all. That we have to decide for ourselves. We can't force this on others. If others still want to continue eating meat, there's nothing we can do about that. But to, if we still have a liking to eat meat and say we are practicing self-investigation, we are deceiving ourselves because we can't go very deep in this practice of self-investigation so long as we are allowing our mind to be clouded and agitated by eating inappropriate foods.
So all the fear.
And this also applies not only to meat and other animal products, it also implies to even plant foods. Alcohol may be produced from plant sources, but we know if you drink alcohol, the immediate effect is it tends to have a regressive effect. People feel very free and they talk more freely if they've had a few drinks. But if you drink more, it becomes a thematic effect and you fall asleep or you become overpowered. So intoxicants like alcohol, tobacco, hashish, and all these so-called recreational drugs, all these are to be avoided if we want to follow this path. And this should be a no-brainer. It should be very obvious to us the reasons for this. If we cannot even see, we are unable to or unwilling to see the reasons for this, then we are not really ready for this path.
And going back to the what you said about indifference, Michael.
Yes.
Back to the question when you were talking about indifference and indifference to the things that happened to you.
Yes.
The more you are able to turn within. And,
yes.
Because I've heard many people that report feelings of apathy towards the world. Not indifference, but apathy.
That is different. That is different.
Yeah, exactly. What is that?
The more indifferent we become to ourselves, the more compassion for others will arise in our heart. Because the... Why we are not compassionate, why we are not caring about others, because of our selfishness, because of our being wrapped up in ourself, being self-centered, meaning ego-centered. We are wrapped up in this little person we take ourselves to be. So only I am Michael and only Michael matters to me. Why should I care about others? Okay, I may care about a few people, those who are near and dear to me, but the rest of the world can go hang. It's nothing to me. Why should I be concerned about others? That is a strong ego that will think like that. But as the ego subsides, we become more and more detached from the person we seem to be. So the distinction between ourself and others begins to dissolve. So when we see others suffering, we suffer seeing them suffer because we feel ourselves to be in their position. So the more the selfishness is removed, the more compassion will grow. And if we lack compassion, that just shows how selfish we are. And selfishness is the very antithesis of self-attentiveness. We have a choice. Do we want to be self-attentive or do we want to be selfish? If we are selfish, we won't be self-attentive. If we are self-attentive, we will, to the extent to which we are self-attentive, to that extent, we will give up selfishness. And to the extent we give up selfishness, we will also naturally have compassion and empathy for others.
What about the activity? Because I was actually referring more to the activities in the world, not relationships so much, but like the things that you typically do, you lose the interest apathy reflects like a state of mind, like
yes.
There's something uncomfortable there or something. So I don't know in which way is being more self-attentive can
that is the more self the more self-attentive we are, the less our actions, the less selfish we will be. And the less selfish we are, the less our actions will be motivated by selfishness. So naturally, our actions will become more compassionate. They'll be driven more by compassion than by selfishness.
And for example, being engaged, you will also naturally feel the pull to be engaged in many things. For example, that could be expression of apathy.
We can feel compassion for others, but we can also recognize our limitations. That is, there is so much suffering in this world. What can we do to alleviate that suffering? There's relatively little. Okay, if we see a hungry person, we can share our food with them. So we do what we can to alleviate the suffering of others, but we don't make it our life mission to alleviate suffering, because if that becomes our aim in life, our mind is going outwards and we are perpetuating this dream. According to Bhagavan, this is all a dream. So if you see a war or a famine or a pandemic or any other form of suffering, what is the best way to put an end to all the suffering you see in a dream? The best way is to wake up. So if we understand that this is all a dream, the best way to put an end to the suffering we see in this dream is to wake up from it. So, though, of course, when our mind is going outwards and we see suffering, but it seems to be within our ability to alleviate, for instance, we see a hungry person and we've got food, and we are able to give food to that person. This may all be according to Prarabdha, but it seems to us that we're able to alleviate. So naturally, we will do those actions that will be conducive to reducing the suffering of others. But we also need to have clear discrimination that the true aim of our life is to wake up from this dream. That is the greatest good we can do to this world, is to wake up from a dream. And in order to wake up from a dream, we need to stop allowing our mind to go outwards. We need to turn it back within.
And one form to do that too is when you are feeling compassionate with other person, no?
Yes.
Because you are projecting and perceiving at the same time as the same thing. That is your creation as ego.
Yes. Yes.
And maybe the best way is try to do two things at the same time, if it's possible. Because you, until perceive that, is because you believe in that, because you're creating that. This is important for you, the illness and all of that. But trying to see this person, not like you see with your eyes.
Yes.
Trying to see what really are this person.
Yes.
To inspire him that he's not this body. To trying to remember to you, no, that this illness that you are seeing, that the cancer that you're seeing is a part of your.
Part of your projection, yes.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
But at the same time, as you see, the fact that this you are seeing that, no?
Yes.
You to try to jump.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you try to do, no?
So long as we are looking outwards, the world seems to be real. So all the people in the world seem to be real, all their suffering seems to be real. But when we see suffering, when we see people who become sick and who die and everything, this should also make us more reflective, because sickness, old age, death, these are inevitable. So long as we take a body to the eye, okay, there may be some people who have the good fortune to be healthy throughout their life. But even the healthiest people, sooner or later, they're going to die. So, and however healthy we may be, some people seem to be still very healthy at the age of 90 or something. They may still be jogging or whatever. It's possible. Most people are not able to be so active when they're 90, but it's possible. But even if you are 90 years old and still able to jog, you will be feeling the effects of age. The effects of age catch up with all of us to a greater or lesser extent sooner or later. So these are all the nature of the body. So these should make us reflect on the unsatisfactory nature of this embodied existence. So this should all motivate us to turn within.
Yes.
And when we see others suffering, we can try to alleviate their suffering to the best of our ability.
But
the real cause of suffering is not the disease or the problems of life. The real cause of suffering is our likes and dislikes.
Not the history that the people is telling about himself.
That's all incidental. The main thing is our likes and dislikes. Our likes and dislikes are what determine what is pleasant and what is unpleasant. If we like something, experiencing it is pleasant. If we dislike it, experiencing it is unpleasant. So it's our likes and dislikes that cause things to seem pleasant or unpleasant. Sometimes you see people who are extremely sick. They may be in a lot of pain and have a terminal illness, but they'll be smiling and very cheerful and very happy because they've come to terms with it. They've accepted their lot. So the real cause of suffering is not the diseases or the financial difficulties or the hunger or any of these things. The real cause of all suffering is our likes and dislikes. And okay. So long as we remain as an ego, we will have likes and dislikes to a greater or lesser extent. We may be able to reduce the strength of our likes and dislikes, but we cannot get rid of likes and dislikes without getting rid of their root, namely ego. So all these are more and more motivation for us to follow this path. The other thing is, regarding what you were saying earlier, that is, if Bhagavan didn't explicitly, Bhagavan recommended ahimsa, we should avoid actions that could cause harm. Bhagavan didn't explicitly prescribe actions that are good. What Bhagavan prescribed is investigate yourself and surrender yourself. The more we investigate ourselves and thereby surrender ourselves, the more subsided we will be, and thereby the purer our mind will become, and thereby our actions will naturally be good actions. So we don't have to worry about actions. As Bhagavan says in the 13th paragraph of Nana, our aim is to surrender to God. However much burden we place on God, he bears all of it. So when that one Parameshwara Shakti is driving all karyas, making whatever is meant to happen or ought to happen, it's making it happen, why should we, instead of yielding ourselves to it, go on thinking it's necessary to do like this, it's necessary to do like this, that. So Bhagavan doesn't want us to be concerned about action. What we need to do is to investigate ourselves and surrender ourselves. If we do that, whatever actions are done by our body, speech, and mind will naturally be good actions to the extent to which ego subsides. Bhagavan says in the final paragraph of Nana, Tanerindal Sakalomum Erum. If oneself rises, everything rises. If oneself subsides, everything subsides. To the extent to which one behaves or conducts oneself subsidingly, that is, sinking low, to the extent to which we conduct ourselves sinking low, to that extent, there is goodness. There is goodness. It's literally what it means. So if we want to be good, subside. And if we are good, whatever actions we do will automatically be good. That is what we need to be. That is, good actions will follow from being good, and being good will follow from subsiding.
And in this situation, no, that you are in front of a person with cancer, no?
Yes.
The first is give the help that you could help, no, to this,
yes, yes, person.
But at the same time, surrender this vision that you have, that is the vision of the ego, that the illness, that this person is a body. No, this is the false testimony that say in the Bible. I think is the real meaning, no, of that. Mm-hmm. Don't give false testimony. Is say that this person is a body. No, and I think it's a double work. No,
in the
first time, give your help, and at the same time recognize that don't buy the ego cell. No, that this person is a body. Is a
That is all good, but all that will follow automatically if we are following this path of Bhagavan. That the more we cling to self-attentionness, the more we will subside. The more we will subside, all these, the right attitude to these things, the right actions, everything will follow. So that's why Bhagavan recommended one thing and one thing alone. Though he presented it in two different ways. He said, either investigate yourself or surrender yourself. But if we actually investigate ourselves, we'll find that itself is self-surrender. And if we try to surrender ourselves, we'll find we cannot surrender ourselves without investigating ourselves. So Bhagavan has actually recommended only one thing. Hold on to yourself. Yeah. You hold on to yourself, that itself is self-investigation, that itself is self-surrender. And all goodness will follow from that. So we need not think too much about these things. Focus on holding on to I. That's the key. And the more we hold on to I, the more clarity will come to the mind, and more all these other things will seem very clear and very obvious.
If I understand you well, Michael, if you point the focus, no, like the mirror in the forest with the newspaper, no, that you say recently, no, if you point, you put your focus, no, in attend yourself and then surrender yourself.
Yes.
You don't need to make any changes of your view or surrender what you are seeing.
It will all happen automatically. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
In the Bible, Jesus says something like, seek you first the kingdom of heaven, and all these things will be added unto you. So that's applicable here. The kingdom of heaven, what is I am. So hold on to I am, and all good qualities will come.
Yes.
Without your even thinking about them. The more we think about them, the less we're holding on to I am. So we're just delaying the process.
Just don't want to put the horses behind the...
Right. Exactly. So that is, Bhagavan has made things so, so simple for us. However great a sinner, he says in Nana, however great a sinner one may be, if instead of lamenting, oh, I'm a sinner, how can I be saved? If one clings firmly to self-attentiveness, one will certainly be saved. So let's not worry about good actions, bad actions, all these things. Let us just cling to self-attentiveness. That doesn't mean that we should be foolish in our actions. For example, Bhagavan has also, in the same Nana, where he says, but we just have to, all we need to do is cling to self-attentiveness. In the same Nana, he's also recommending, for example, Mitta Sattvika Ahara Niyama, of eating only moderate quantities of food. So we don't want to do anything to obstruct this process. So what is conducive to this, going deeper in this path of clinging to I am, eating moderate quantities of sattvic food. That is why this is an important niyama, but we don't dwell upon that. Once we've decided, okay, now we're going to try to eat only sattvic food and in moderate quantities. So we give up all meat, eggs, animal products, all intoxicants and everything. And we live a very, we don't have to do anything to give up meat. It's very simple. The easiest thing, we're just letting go of things. We're not doing anything special.
Yes.
But the most important thing, clinging to I am. If you cling to I am, everything else will automatically drop off.
Right. One.
So the question here was about selfishness. But as I say, if you want to overcome selfishness, cling to self-attentiveness. Self-attentiveness is the remedy for selfishness, because we are selfish only so long as we're looking away from other things. So away at other things, we're looking away from ourselves towards other things. When we're looking at other things, we seem to be this ego, and the ego is the root that gives rise to all selfishness. But if you want to be free of all selfishness, look at the ego itself. Ego will thereby subside, and all selfishness will subside along with it. So, coming back to the question, just to finish off this, the question was: if we are not even teaching others, we are just discussing with others Bhagavan's teachings. Because who are we to teach anything? But we are sharing our understanding of Bhagavan's teachings with others and having discussions. We do so because the more our mind dwells on Bhagavan's teachings, the more inclination we have to go within. The more we have inclination to go within, the more ego will subside. The more ego will thereby subside. And the more selfishness will thereby drop off. So, as I say, self-attentiveness is a remedy for selfishness.
And you said, Michael, that I heard you say sometimes that you just need to understand the general principles of Bhagavan's teachings, and that would be enough.
Yes, yes, like, yes.
But why, because both of you understand to a certain extent, okay, not perfectly, because that would be the end of the path.
Yes.
But I mean, fairly well, the general principles of the teaching. So why not, instead of keep reading, instead of keep talking about it, why not just leave the teachings?
Good question. But so long as the mind continues to come outwards, under the sway of our Vishaya-vasanas, we need Bhagavan's teachings to remind us to go back within. That's why we are constantly thinking about and talking about his teaching. If we are thinking about his teachings and talking about his teachings properly, we'll be practicing self-attentiveness while doing so. Because what are his teachings all about? What are his teachings pointing at? They're pointing only at ourselves. So if we are really understanding his teachings, merely thinking about his teachings will put us back into the state of self-attentiveness.
It's what you said so many times, no? That the traveler don't let it go the map, no?
No.
And you arrive, no? The destination.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Bhagavan's teaching, sometimes people say, oh, the teachings are just a signpost. You have to follow the signpost. A better analogy is the teachings are like a map. The map you take with you, it continues to serve a purpose till you reach your destination. The map becomes more and more meaningful the closer you get to your destination. Because then once you've actually traveled on the path, what if the map is showing you becomes more meaningful. That is, you're able to recognize, oh, this feature on this map corresponds to such and such an experience. So it all becomes, our understanding of Bhagavan's words becomes deeper and clearer to the extent to which we put them into practice. And the deeper and clearer that they become, the more they enthuse us, the more they give us that enthusiasm to put them into practice.
And other point, Michael, respected this question of the teaching of if we teach for whom we teach, no?
Yeah,
is at least in my case, no. I feel that the illusion that you can help others,
yes,
is a very big temptation of the ego. No?
It's a very 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 dangerous to think like that. Yeah.
And and too many speakers, no, about these teachings.
Yeah.
Tell the people something that is not really, really sincerely with him, with them. Yeah. No? And when you discover very clear that you can help anyone, yes, because you are old, you need to forgive you.
Yeah.
Of all what you see with this ego in the support, no, in the data, no.
Yes.
And I think it's revealed that we are happy, no, when some people say, this answer is useful for me, no. I understand. But you are not the creator of.
Exactly. That is, we need to understand if at all anyone is helped by anything that we say or write, or it is not we who are helping them, it is Bhagavan who is helping them.
Yes.
That is, we are, what can we do? We haven't saved ourselves. How can we save others? So
and we are not the medium, no, or the channel. No, this is another form of ego too.
Yeah. I am the chosen channel. Yes. Yes. Just so happens, Bhagavan will use any worthless thing. He used an old leaky pen and the edges of newspapers to write his verses. So the instrument isn't important to Bhagavan. He will use any worthless instrument to do his work. So we shouldn't feel pride at all. Through me, Bhagavan is doing this. It just so happens that well, he had his own way of doing things, and who are we to understand these things? So our only mission, if we are truly following Bhagavan's path, is to subside more and more and more. That is what we are here for. Yes. And if his teachings and thinking, reading them, talking about them, thinking about them is helpful to the extent to which it helps us to subside. If it is not helping us to subside, if it is making us proud, or I understand these things very well, I can teach others, I can help others. If it's giving us such pride, it is worse than useless. If we've really understood Bhagavan's teachings are all about subsiding. As he says, if we conduct ourselves sinking low, to the extent to which we conduct ourselves sinking low, to that extent there is goodness. In the last paragraph of Nana, he says. So we need to be more and more humble.
Yes.
That is, more and more humble means subsiding. How do we subside? By clinging firmly to I am.